So good morning, and I guess you say happy 4th of July. As we just heard, this topic, this has been a series. The Chevra Kedisha has sponsored it, and all the topics have had to do with issues surrounding death and dying. We did about funerals and burials and all kinds of different things. So we've done this on all the national holidays for this year, and Emir Hashem, we'll do it again for next year's national holidays with a new set of topics. So definitely thank you to the Chevra Kedisha for their sponsorship of this year's national holiday series of breakfast. Also, thank you to Rabbi Netanel, who was the trigger behind making all of this happen, and who put in all the hard legwork to make it happen. And particularly, thank you for the eggs. They were really good this morning. Just the way I like them, too.
I mean, it's the first time I actually had to make them myself.
Wow.
We'll tell your mother you did it.
So, right, they did a great job on the eggs. They're just the way we like them. So, Yashar Koyach to Rabbi Netanel for making this happen. When we planned this out and we picked out the topics, I was oblivious to the fact that the 4th of July would fall in the week of Parshas Pinchas, and that Parshas Pinchas is one of the primary sources in the Torah on the topic of inheritance. Right? There's really two sources. No one's going to come up Matas Masei, Pinchas is the prime source on the topic of inheritance. So we did not have that in mind, but it comes out that it is the source, because the story is the daughters of Tzelophehad. So Tzelophehad was a man who died in the desert, and he may have been the one who was picking up the sticks, and then they on the Shabbos day, and was executed. And actually the Gemara considers the possibility that he really did it as an act of altruism. He almost sacrificed himself so that people would understand that desecration of the Shabbos is very serious. So the daughters come along and they say, we're about to enter into the land of Israel. We want our father's share. Because our father didn't die with one of the bad guys, like Korach. He wasn't one of those evil people. He was a good man. And we deserve his share. And he had no sons, so we should get his share. Actually, the Gemara in Yevamos says it wasn't quite as simple as it looks from the Torah. It wasn't just simply that they were sticking up for women's rights, and therefore they've become the darlings of all biblical women's rights movements. It wasn't really that at all. It was really a little bit more complicated. Everyone understood that the daughters will get a share in the absence of any sons. What they really wanted was, they said they were deserving of a double share because of both their father and a grandfather who had also left Egypt, who both should have gotten independent shares in Israel, and they should be the heirs of both of those. Anyway, that's a complexity in the Gemara Yevamos, which we won't get into. But the bottom line is, Moshe is stymied. He doesn't really know what to do. This is one of the places in the Torah where Moshe didn't know what to do. He had to go back to God. And God says, and this is in this week's Parsha, it's in Perek Chav Zayin, chapter 27, Psukim 6 through 11. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, so Hashem spoke to Moshe, and he said, the Cain, benos Tzelophehad dovros, yes, the daughters of Tzelophehad, they are right. You should surely give them a possession of an inheritance amongst their father's brethren, and you should cause the inheritance of their father to pass on to them. And then he says, and now speak unto the children of Israel, and I'm going to give you a general rule. If a man dies and he has no son, then the inheritance shall go to his daughter. Which, by the way, it seems as though this is not really a good source, if you're, just as an aside, if you're a egalitarian and you're sticking up for the rights of women and you want to talk about the daughters of Tzelophehad, the daughters of Tzelophehad only get a portion if there are no sons. Only if there are no sons. So, you know, it doesn't matter who they were or what they were. you know, if there had been a son, the son would have gotten everything. But in the absence of any sons, then it goes to the daughters. And if he has no daughters, then you give an inheritance to his brothers. Okay? So a man dies, the property all goes to his son. If it doesn't go to, if there's no son for it to go to, it goes to his daughter. If there's no daughter for it to go to, it goes to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you give an inheritance unto his father or father's brothers. So, no sons, no daughters, then go back up. Give it to his father. No father. Does his father have a brother? Okay. Then, and if his father has no brothers, then you should give an inheritance on the kinsman that is next to him of his family, and he shall possess it. Okay, so now, how does this basically work? So the order of inheritance according to the Torah is a son and his descendants. So let's say a man dies and he doesn't have a son, but he had a son. His son had already predeceased him. And the son left children. It would go to those children, to the grandchildren. Meaning, you go to the next person in order or their descendants. So, you have a man, he dies. He had a son, but his son had predeceased him. But his son left children. So you go to his grandchildren, which means the children of the deceased son. Okay? If he didn't have a son, you go to the daughter. If the daughter had predeceased him, you go to the daughter's son. Now here's an interesting thing. There's a little anomaly here. It could be that a man's estate will end up going to his granddaughter, and his daughter will get nothing. Why? A man had a son. The son had a daughter. Man had a son and a daughter. When he dies, the estate goes to his son. His son's not alive, but his son's daughter is alive. The estate will go to his son's daughter. It won't go to the deceased's own daughter. It'll go to her niece, to the deceased son's daughter. Right? It's just an interesting little thing. So you could end up having a situation where a granddaughter inherits the entire estate. And by the way, this is everything. It goes, we don't divide it up into portions unless there's equal. So if a man has three sons, then you'll divide it up. But if he only has, let's say, one son, we'll keep it simple. Everything goes to that son. He has a son and a daughter. Everything goes to the son. It only goes to the daughter in the absence of any sons or descendants from that son. So you could have a granddaughter inheriting the estate, even though a man has a living daughter. A man dies and he has a living daughter and he has a granddaughter through his son. The granddaughter through his son will get the entire estate, and his own daughter won't get anything from that estate, according to Allah. Yeah.
Is there a requirement, though, to take care of the parent? But so let's say man dies, gives it to his son or daughter. What about the wife?
We'll get to the wife in just a minute. Yeah, wife's coming up, right. By the way, and all this I've been saying the man, it could be a woman also. If a woman dies and she leaves behind an estate, then the estate will go to her son. And if she doesn't have a son, it'll go to her daughter, and so on and so forth. Okay. If it doesn't, and if she doesn't have a son or a daughter, it'll go back up to her. It'll go to her brothers. And if she doesn't have brothers, it'll go back up to her father. And if the father is deceased, and he left no other survivors, or he produced no other descendants beside himself, it'll go out to his brothers, and so on and so forth. And what will happen is that somewhere along the line, unless a person is a convert to Judaism, there will be an heir somewhere. Because you will keep going back up the line. Man died. He left behind he had no descendants. So you go back to his father. Father is dead. Did the father and he had no other children other than the dead man. Did the father have brothers? You'll go out to the brothers. Did the brothers have descendants? You know, maybe the brothers are all dead, but did any of them have descendants? You know. Well, you go back up one step further. Ultimately, I mean, you know, if you have to, you'll get back to Avraham Avinu. But somewhere along the line, you'll find someone who had descendants, and you'll trace them down, and you'll go, and they might be dead, and their children are dead, and their children are dead, but you'll find someone who is living today, and he will get the estate, no matter how far out you have to go. Okay, if they're multiple brothers, they'll divide equally. Now, first, before we talk about husband and wife, there is another rule, and that is, of the sons, if there is a firstborn son, he gets a double portion. That means, firstborn son, so let's say there are three sons. A man dies and he leaves behind three sons. One is the firstborn, and the other two. So you divide the estate into four equal portions. The firstborn will take two of those, and the other two sons will each take one portion. Okay, so he gets a double portion. He gets double of what his brothers got. Okay? Yeah?
Is that only the firstborn son?
Only the firstborn son, not the oldest son, the firstborn son. Yeah. So he's got to be a firstborn. Right. So if, let's say, there is a girl who was born first, a girl, and then she had three brothers. The three brothers will divide equally the estate. The estate does not go to that eldest son, doesn't have any advantage, only a firstborn son. Not the oldest son, the firstborn. He has to be firstborn, otherwise he has no advantage.
But if two sons died.
What's that?
If first sons died.
So if the first son died, then you still have to see, did he leave children? You have to go to see his children.
He was young.
Okay, if he died young, then he doesn't count. He's erased from the equation.
So next sons be.
So the next sons are all equal. No one takes the position of first son. There's only one first son. There only can be one first son. If he's deceased and he left no heirs, then he's gone. But if he left heirs, he gets a double portion, and the double portion goes to his children. Yeah.
What if your Bechor is twin brothers? Do you just give the double portion to the...
Can't have Bechor twin brothers.
How about
one of them has got to be older. That seems to be a fact. Best I understand, I don't know. Maybe there's some doctors here who can tell me otherwise. But
why my question? Because Solomon was second son for King David.
Yeah.
Because first son was died.
Right. So he didn't. I don't know if he got a double portion. I don't know if he got. What did he get?
So daughters don't get nothing or what? I don't.
Daughters. So right now, daughters get nothing. Daughters get nothing.
If you give.
If there's a son. If there's no son, daughter gets everything.
No, it's
got to go to son first.
No.
The son first. If there are no sons, then it goes to daughters. Otherwise, daughters get nothing. I'm giving you the straight law according to the Torah. Okay? We have to first understand how the Torah structures this, and then we'll see where we want to go with it. Okay? So, we now know it goes to sons, and by the way, when someone has passed away and they left no descendants and you're going back up, you'll always go up to the father, to the father's side. You don't go into the mother's side at all. So, for example, if someone had a stepfather, they won't get anything from that stepfather's inheritance because they're not related. They're not a descendant of that stepfather. Okay? Yeah.
You mentioned converts earlier.
Yeah.
Did that come into play?
So all I'm saying about the converts is a convert is the only person who might die and leave. If he leaves no heirs, his estate, they won't have a relative for the estate to go to.
So he's a convert that his other family
Right, it's possible that, right, because he didn't have family members. He didn't have brothers, he didn't have fathers. Like, that's the only scenario that you could come up with. Otherwise, every other born Jew will have a relative somewhere. You might have to go all the way back to Avraham, but you'll find one somewhere. Okay. Yeah.
So if you're the stepfather, you don't have to be entitled to a stepfather's assets.
That's right. That's
right. Say you're a widower or a woman, her father died.
Yeah.
And she gets the inheritance.
Right.
She has children with a man.
Yeah.
Her husband dies.
Right.
She remarries. Does that husband, is now her wealth her husband?
So let's talk about wives. We have firstborn, now let's get to wives, okay? How do wives work in all of this? Okay, so a husband inherits his wife, but not vice versa. So if a woman has assets, and she passes away, her estate automatically goes, her assets automatically go to her husband. But if a man passes away, his assets do not go to his wife. Right? They follow the rules that we have set here. The woman, if a woman doesn't have a husband, single woman, she might have children. Right now she does not have a husband. And she passes away, then it'll go to her sons. If she doesn't have sons, it'll go to her daughters. If she doesn't have sons or daughters, it'll go back to her father and all that stuff, right? But if she is married, no questions, it goes straight to her husband. Even if she has sons and daughters from different marriages and all that type of stuff, the estate goes, her estate, her assets go to her husband. That's the basic rule.
So by definition, let's say a grandfather dies, gives everything to his daughter.
Right.
The daughter has kids, but then remarries, becomes a widower, and
right.
Then all the grandfather's assets would lose his lineage.
That's right, and this makes for interesting Gemaras in both Maseches Ksuvos and in Maseches Yevamos, because people were reluctant to, let's say, give their assets to their daughter for fear of the assets leaving the family and going into his family. And there's all kinds of ways that people tried to do things to structure them so that wouldn't happen. You know? So, but I'm trying to get the basic structure. But you're right. These are all issues that people are thinking about, because the guy's thinking, hey, you know, I've got my estate. If this all goes to my daughter and she's married, then it all ends up in his family, and you know, none of my heirs and none of my sons, it's all gone. It all goes over to the other family, and who wants all of that? Right? Okay, so just a few words about a wife. It doesn't mean the wife doesn't get the inheritance, but one of the things that a wife is entitled to is support. So the sons who inherit the estate are obligated to support the widow, whether that be their mother or someone else, the father's wife. The sons who inherit, whoever inherits the estate, is obligated to support the father's widow for as long as she wants, in the same level, style and fashion as she had been supported during his lifetime.
Where's the source of that authority?
That's part. That's in the Ksuva. That's in the Ksuva. Yeah, that's in the Ksuva. So therefore, he dies. She doesn't get anything, but she does get support. She continues to receive that support until she does one of two things. She could demand the lump sum payment of her Ksuva. If she does, they have to give her the lump sum payment and then they're cut free. Or she gets remarried. Generally, what will happen is she will demand the lump sum payment but then get remarried. Right. You know, if she has half a brain anyway. Or her husband has half a brain. Or her new husband has half a brain. Yeah. Yes, that is out of the estate. That's a good point. That is out of the estate. If the assets of the estate are gone, then they're not obligated to keep paying her out of pocket. You know, as long as the estate is there, they keep paying. Yeah, all this is out of the estate because it's an obligation of the husband of his estate. The only reason the sons are obligated is because they inherited the estate, and the estate basically has a lien on it. She really has a lien on it to provide expenses. Yeah.
So, again, it's a little confusing because this is all before sort of the banking principles. So, realistically, you know, there is no estate per se when somebody passes away. If it's land or cattle or whatever
right.
it was, I mean, that's passed on. There is no more bank. So how do you determine the level of support that wife or that mother would get?
Right, so, you know, if she was living in the home, for example, they have to continue to support her in a home of the same style that she was living with when she was with their father. And she took a couple of trips a year, she gets a couple of trips a year, and she bought clothing and all those type of things. She gets that, she continues to live at that level. Now, you can imagine, this could get into an ugly situation because she's going to make demands and they're going to say, what do you mean? You know, and dad never did that with you and all that. And she said, no, you know, your father used to give me $1,000 every week for spending money. And they said, what are you talking about? You know, okay, so you can see why it would be an ugly situation. And, but that's the way it's supposed to work. Okay. So I'm just right now, I'm really just trying to lay out the general framework. Okay, now, unmarried daughters, by the way, unmarried daughters also receive maintenance until they become mature. 12. Okay? Bat mitzvah, right? So they, unmarried daughters also, as a tanai, as a condition of the ksuba, they receive maintenance until they're age of 12. The unmarried daughters are also entitled to a dowry. Every daughter gets a dowry, and the dowry could be as much as 10% of the estate, because it is assumed that if the father were alive, he would offer a dowry to marry off his daughters. He would have wanted to marry off his daughters, and he would have put up a dowry equivalent to up to 10% of his estate. And therefore, the heirs of the estate have to take care of those girls until they're 12, and they also have to put up dowries for them so those girls can get married. Okay, now, let's go back to a couple of things. I just want to take for a little bit about the Bechor. So now, let's get into some a little bit more contemporary issues. We said that the Bechor, the firstborn, gets a double portion. But, he only gets a double portion of liquid, of assets, of real assets that exist right now. He does not get a double portion of any money that is owed to the father, that is to be collected. So let's say someone owes the father $100, and that person pays the estate the $100 that they owed the father, then the brothers divide that up equally. It's only after, if it came after death, only assets that were there, cash assets, liquid assets, or real estate that existed at the time of death. But anything that was paid, you know, a person has debts. Now, nowadays, that would include bank accounts. Because bank accounts are loans. Bank accounts are loans, right? You know, you go to the bank, they do not have your money sitting in a box somewhere. Okay, you lent them the money, they promise to pay you back the money. Most investments are loans. Probably even stock, unless maybe you're like your own controlling interest in a company, that might be different. But someone just owns like minority shares, that probably also is a form of a loan. So those things, so the son, the firstborn son, would get a double portion of the house, right? double portion of any cash assets, maybe any things that are in the house, then you'd get a double portion of. But as far as the bank accounts and all that, the brothers were all divided equally.
You're saying a bank account is a debt.
Bank account is a debt. Halachically, bank account is a debt. You lent the money to the bank, and you hope that they will pay you back. And even if it says your accounts are secured, but they're only secured up to $100,000, and if there's a run on the banks and the banking system is collapsing, then they won't be secured. So they're secured until they're not secured. So, you know, yeah.
Rabbi, so is someone has like a box for 100 shares of Home Depot in their safe deposit box. That's considered a loan?
Yeah, it's a loan because it's not real money. You know, you have to go and Home Depot. You lent Home Depot money, right? And they'll pay you back your money. Sometimes they pay you back with some interest or not, whatever, but it's a loan. Most of those cases, loan. Now, if you happen to be controlling interest in Home Depot, you know, if you're Bernie Marcus, so then maybe the shares of Home Depot, that's real, because that's real ownership. You know, that indicates ownership. But on small level, stock is not really ownership. That's just instruments of... That's just investment things, and you know that's a different story. Yeah.
Well, the house is not sold yet, so you're leaving the house there. So how does Bahor get, you know, two portions of that house when it's not really sold?
Yes, yeah, so, you know, if it has, say, if there are four bedrooms, he gets two of them.
but is that for later?
Yeah, no, that's not a loan. That is really owned. That is totally owned by them. That's a real asset. There's owned.
The intention of when it's sold, and he's going to get. Double.
Yeah, he'll get double from when they sell it. But it is a real asset right now, and he owns double a portion in that house compared to all of his brothers. And when they sell it, and they turn that from a house into cash, he'll take double the portion of cash. That's it. Okay, fine. So now, let's get to... another thing. Husbands and wives. There is another thing, which is, we have something in the United States called joint tenancy, right? Where you own things, so we said the wife doesn't get the husband's estate, okay? However, on the deed into my house has my name and my wife's name on it, right? So therefore, my house, if a man dies and he and his wife are joint owners of the home, so that house is not subject to inheritance. She wouldn't inherit the house. She owns the house. Right? So that when we say that the assets don't go to the wife, that's the assets that are subject to inheritance go to the sons, but not the wives. But some assets are not subject to inheritance. The minute that the husband dies, the wife becomes the total owner of the house. And similarly, if you set up any joint banking accounts or any other investments or instruments that you have, and they're jointly owned by husband and wife, that's not subject to inheritance. So the laws of halachic inheritance would not affect those assets. She would become the immediate owner of them, the way things work in our society, and therefore the laws of inheritance won't affect them. Now, it is worth noting that not everyone agrees that the halachically in these ownership structures, these financial ownership constructs that have been created in our society. And also, if a guy, if sometimes his wife's name is on the assets, but it's not really, they're not really her assets. I mean, sometimes they really are, but sometimes they really aren't. Sometimes they just put her name on there. You know, the guy that was in shul, and they went to give him an aliyah. So the gabbai said, "What's your name?" So he said, "My name is Sarah." So the gabbai said, "Sarah? It's a strange name for a man. Why do you have a name like Sarah?" He says, "Shh, I've been having some problems. I had to put everything in my wife's name." Okay. So sometimes the wife really owns it. Right. They really are joint owners. But sometimes her name is just on there. And if her name is just on there, then really it's questionable whether halacha recognizes that as real ownership. and therefore, and if she takes the house, that might be violating the laws of inheritance in the Torah. So, therefore, there is some confusion about that. Not all poskim agree on this, and therefore, as they advise, we're going to show you a method whereby other people can get shares of the inheritance, and therefore, even some assets that you might consider to really be the wife's, maybe they're not really the wife's, and therefore, they should be taken into consideration when we make our kosher wills. Yeah.
I'm curious, does it seem like that I found it to be the case that the wife or the woman would have to then still give out the assets to the firstborn, and even though she owns it, but we're saying that that halakhically, I'm not saying that it should be that way, but halakhically she doesn't have to even do that to dole it out kind of to the sons.
If she's a joint, if she and her husband were joint owners,
she owns it.
It's not subject to the laws of inheritance. It's just outside of this entire discussion. She takes the house, it's my house, and when the kids, for example, father dies, all the assets that she held jointly with her husband are hers. Whenever she didn't hold jointly with her husband, that's subject to inheritance, and that'll follow these laws. But otherwise, it's just off the board. Although I said not all poskim agree with that, with these joint ownership, and sometimes they are also are legal fictions, you know, where he put something in his wife's name, but he really owned it. So then, for sure, the halacha is very questionable about whether she's the real owner of that. So kind of hold off on that for a minute. We're going to get back to that. So here's the deal. Let's get down to our real issue here. It says in the Torah, the last pasuk that was talking in this week's parsha that talks about inheritance says, "So it shall be to his children, to the children of Israel, l'chukas mishpat, kasher tzivah Hashem es Moshe. It shall be a chukas mishpat." Now that's a very strong language. Chukas, you know, the word chok is always talks about laws that are not understandable. It's just the way it is. The red heifer is a chok. You know, milk and meat is a chok. There's nothing to talk about. That's just the way it is. And it says, chukas mishpat. This is a chok that governs mishpat. Mishpat is generally justice, judgment. So here's a chok that governs mishpat. And what that means is, this is an absolute law. And from this, the Gemara derives, and is codified in the Shulchan Aruch very clearly, that this is the way it's supposed to be. And if someone doesn't do this, they are violating the Torah, not only Torah law, but the natural way of the world. And they could be violating that in one of two ways. Either by passing it out to someone that's not supposed to receive it, according to Torah law, that's one violation, or receiving it when someone else is supposed to get it. And if you're receiving something that someone else is supposed to get, for example, let's say there is an estate, and they probate the will, and in the will it says, the person says, although I have three sons, my firstborn son and his two brothers, they're a bunch of good-for-nothing bums, and I'm disgusted with them, but Rabbi Friedman at Congregation Ariel has always been such a mensch, and what a wonderful guy, I'm leaving my entire estate to him. Okay, beautiful, right. The only problem is, if Rabbi Friedman takes the estate, he's stealing from the brothers. According to the Torah, he's stealing from the brothers. So the guy did wrong in making that will, according to the Torah. Now, according to the laws of the United States, of course, everything executed 100%, right? But, so what I would really have to do is, according to the Torah, I have to go back to the brothers and say, hey guys, this is really yours according to the Torah. But you know, your father really wanted me to have it. So can I have it? Yeah. Good luck. Okay.
So
then people who leave parts of their estates to charitable organizations technically shouldn't be doing that.
Very, okay, so questionable, and it needs to be done in a proper way. So here, this is the issue. As a matter of fact, I'll give you an exact example. This is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah. The Ramah quotes the Mordechai. A woman had children, and she died. Okay, I don't know, husband, no husband in the picture, and the woman had children. She had a bag of gold, sack of gold, coins. She had a trusted executor. Before she died, she gave the executor the bag of gold, and she said, upon my demise, distribute this money in the best way. That's what she told him. Distribute this money in the best way.
It's my package.
So he died. She died. He, the executor, went to Mordechai, who was a great rabbi, and said to him, what's the best way? What is the best way? You know, there's charitable institutions, there were paupers in town, there's, you know, all kinds of things. Like, yeah, and it seemed as though her children were not so, as they like to say in Yiddish, ay, 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 right? They weren't so ay, 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 because obviously she would have given it to them if they were such good people, but obviously they weren't such good people, and she wanted to go in the best way, and the best way was not her sons, right? So he asked the Mordechai, and the Mordechai said, and this is codified by the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch, the Mordechai said, the best way is to give it to the sons the way the Torah said to. Even though they're not such good guys, and even though he was proposing charitable institutions and all that stuff. And Mordechai said, give it to the sons, follow the order as ordained by the Torah, not charitable institutions. Do not delete any of the sons, and don't give it to any other people. That was the ruling. So therefore you see, we are supposed to try to see to it, to follow the Torah's order of inheritance. Now, practically, what is a person to do if he wants to have it go a different way? Nowadays, many, many people want to divide up their estate equally amongst all the children, sons and daughters. You've got sons, daughters, you want to divide it up equally. Maybe they want to give something to their grandchildren, they want to give something to charitable institutions, they want to, all this, you know. You have lots of things that you want to do. So first of all, the best way to do a lot of this is to do it while you're alive. So if you really want the money to go to the charitable institution, so then give it to the charitable institution while you are still living. Okay? Create a fund, make them joint owners, all kinds of things like that. Give the gifts as much. But, you know, it doesn't always work out like that, A. And B is, there's always new assets that could be coming in at any time. What happens to those and all that? So what if someone wants to give to all of his children? So there is a children, boys and girls, equally. So there is a method called chatzi zochor, half male. The reason they call it half male is because at the time that this was devised, but this goes back hundreds of years, at the time this was devised, people particularly wanted to give their daughters one half portion of what the sons got. You know, just like the Bechor, the firstborn son, got a double. So they would want to give their daughters also. They wanted to give the daughters. And they also, it was felt that if someone gave a guarantee that the daughter was going to be getting part of the estate, it made her much more marriageable, attractive, you know, because someone wants to marry her because they know that hopefully down the line she'll get a piece of the estate. And the standard amount in those days was half of what the boys got. Nowadays, it's pretty much equal. Okay, in a contemporary, you know, most people think they have a son and a daughter, two sons, two daughters, whatever they got. Most people are thinking, I want to divide up my estate equally amongst all of the children. Okay, so if they have this situation, and in the Geshur HaChaim writes about this, and the Geshur HaChaim actually tells the story. Geshur HaChaim is a fascinating work. It came from Eretz Yisrael, and more than a century ago. And the Geshur HaChaim writes of a story where a father was very, very careful to make sure that all of his estate followed rigorously the laws of the Torah. And it ended up inspiring a fight between his children that became extremely bitter and ripped the community apart, and all kinds of warring factions, created all kinds of negativity. So the Geshur HaChaim says, if you have a circumstance where you are afraid that there will be recriminations and it'll lead to arguments in the community, so then you can use this institution called Chatzi Zohar. But it doesn't have to be. Chatzi Zohar literally, as I said, means half male, but that's just because the way it used to be, could be anything. What do you do? So this is commonly used even till today. So what do you do? First of all, you determine how you would like your estate to be divided up amongst the people you want to be divided up. And you write up a will with that list of determinations, right? I've got 5 kids. Each of them should get an equal portion, right? That's what you want to see. Or, you know, want to see all my assets go to my wife, and you might even include even the house, even though she is already a joint owner, put it in anyway, because just to avoid any questions about that, okay? All the assets go to my wife. After that, you know, then to the children, or however you want to do it. Or, you know, I want 1/4 of my assets to divide to go to my children, but 3/4 of my assets go to Congregation Ariel. That's the way I want it, right? Good. Then what you do is, you, in front of witnesses, and you can even write this up, preferably written up, but certainly in front of witnesses, you gift all of the people who are not part of the halachic inheritance, all the people in your list that are not part of your halachic inheritance, you gift them, you indebt yourself to them amounts that are greater than the value of your entire estate. So you say, okay, so let's say I have 3 daughters and 2 sons, in my case, okay? So what I would say is, I gift to my daughters $1 million each. Okay? That's greater than the value of my entire estate. Okay. And that is to be paid by my heirs. Unless my halachic heirs choose to follow the order of inheritance as I have outlined in this separate inheritance document. So now, my sons will have an option. They can either give each of their sisters $1 million each, which, you know, that's the debt that they inherited from their father, which far exceeds the value of the estate, or they can choose to divide the whole estate up equally in 5 equal portions. And that way, they'll at least walk away with 1/5 of the estate. The other way, they'd walk away with 0. They would give away the entire estate. They wouldn't have to come out of pocket, but they would get nothing. So, and the same thing, and you can do that to Congregation Ariel or whoever it might be. And that is generally the methodology that is followed. Now, one other thing I just want to say, I'll take your questions, and that will pretty much wrap it up. And all of the indebtedness, two points. Number one is, this indebtedness I do not obligate myself to my daughters right now. I obligate myself to my daughters 1 minute before my demise. In front of witnesses, I obligate myself to my daughters 1 minute before my demise. 1 minute before my demise, that's when they are now owed $1 million from my estate. And I usually pick a number that exceeds like the entire value of the estate. So at that point, upon my demise, each of my daughters now is owed $1 million from the estate. And the heirs of my estate, which would be my sons, they now have one of two choices. Either pay them, give them everything, give them the entire estate, which won't match up to $1 million, give them whatever there is, or divide according to this alternative document, which you and I call a will, that I laid out how the other way I want it, in which case everyone gets an equal portion or something like that. That's one thing. Now, the other thing is that so you did it a minute before they died. There's one last point I was going to make, and that is, oh, yeah. So this is not considered to be subverting the will, that this should be done. Yeah, this should be done only if there is reason to believe that if I don't do it that way, it'll lead to strife. Only if I feel that the children will start arguing with each other and the daughters will say, here for the last 10 years I've been feeding father, you know, spoon feeding him, and I turned my house upside down and I made a special bedroom for him and now I get nothing, you know, and it'll lead to strife and hatred. That's why you'd want to do this. But if it won't, if everyone really is going to respect the situation, then you should try to follow the halachic rules. Also, even so, we are advised that the sons should get some more. And I recently advised this, basically in preparation for this. I really came to understand a lot of these concepts, which, you know, I love these classes, they're always wonderful because the guy who prepares it learns it so much. I had a lot of questions, and I got a lot of them answered in the process of preparing this. So, recently I advised a family that was actually going through a circumstance like this, that there is a halachic executor of the will. And the wishes were basically to divide the estate equally. However, it was very, very clear in the will that the executor was given free rein to do as they saw fit. It was specifically that the Jewish Orthodox executor was given free rein to divide up however, but it also said that the preference would be to divide everything equally. So I said, divide the estate equally, however, give some more, a bit more, to the sons. Give a bit more to the sons. In this case, it said give each son $1,000 more. And that it seems to be standard practice in halacha, is that you give the sons more so that you show that you're not subverting the Torah's idea. The Torah wants the sons to receive the primary, and so you show that you're not subverting it. You're not making an egalitarian statement. What you're doing is you recognize the Torah law, you gave the sons some more, but on the other hand, Torah law also does not want strife and hard feelings amongst people, so you can use this other situation. So, therefore, the two things, first of all, there's a factor of, there's a fear of strife, hard feelings. There might also be feelings of that the children have enough money, the shul needs money, or something like that, you know. And it won't be, if it's felt, for example, that the children are all, you know, comfortable, and if money is left to the shul, there won't be hard feelings. Okay, generally it's always hard feelings, but you know. So in those cases, you could leave to other institutions or other people, and the halacha is determined. Even so, you should still show recognition of the Torah system by giving the sons a little bit more than the daughters, a small percentage, but a little bit more, just to show that you do recognize the Torah system, and that is all those. That's common practice today. And that's what I have to say. And if anyone has any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Like, to the point that you just made, thank you very much for expressing the presentation. The point you just made about if the secular law in the Torah kind of has that, then you're trying to make a kind of a compromise with that too. So have we had instances, real life instances recently, where the secular law had to, like someone was very strongly wanting to make sure that halachic will or halachic takes precedence and is used over the secular law, but the will was already in place and they kind of had to fight that battle. I don't know. A lawyer in the house may know some of that as well. Have we had instances like that? And what won out in the situation?
Yeah, so, you know, the law of land, by the way, everyone talks about, you know, this is a common question that comes up. Isn't, we have a rule in the Torah, the law of the land is law, right? Dina demachlus sedina, the law of the land is law. So doesn't that override? The law of the land is only the law vis-a-vis when it's me, the Jew, vis-a-vis the state, the common good, or another non-Jew. But when it's just between Jew and Jew, the law of the land is not the law. The law of the Torah is the law. Right? So when I'm driving down the street, I have to follow all the laws of the land because that's me vis-a-vis the state, the common good. Or when I'm dealing with my next door neighbor, Mr. King, right, then I have to follow the laws of the state. But if I'm dealing with my next door neighbor on the other side, who's Jewish, we follow the Torah law. Now, generally, that's why this is a really, really big issue, because there are times when people will receive inheritances that are not, from maybe some relative or something like that, that are not in accordance with Torah law, and that's why it's really important to know this. Not only, everyone thinks of like how I give out my inheritance. No, it's how I receive also. If I get a phone call, you know, your uncle left you all this money, I have to stop and say, wait a second. Am I allowed to take this money? Because I might actually be stealing, halachically stealing, from someone else. You have to investigate. You can't just take. You know, it's really very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the synagogue world, there's all this legacy thing now. So I just want to make sure I understand it. So let's say someone just doesn't tell you that, but they... maybe a portion to Ariel.
Yeah.
You have to go to the family and say.
So really, that should be written up, and assets and things should be either transferred or created trusts, and you know, trusts and the rights of survivorship and all that. I'm not prepared to get into the specifics of that, but it should be done in consultation with a inheritance attorney who is conversant with halacha, so that it is structured the right way. Now, like I said, one way, the classic way to do it is you create this debt, and then the heirs have to, you know, they have to, or they're smart, they'll deal with it, because otherwise they'll walk away with nothing. But in those, you have to know to speak to, and there are a number of really, there are a number of very, very Torah educated attorneys, inheritance attorneys, who are very good at this, and they understand. But it's not so simple. Not so simple. And if someone didn't do any of that, and the Torah and Congregation Ariel receives a gift from someone's will, you know, there's questions about how that goes. Yeah.
So regarding gifting to daughters or other institutions, can you revoke that? Is that irrevocable?
That is revocable.
That is revocable.
That is revocable because it only takes place a moment before death.
Okay.
That's why you do that. That's exactly why you do that, right? You say, because you don't want to create a debt to your daughter right now. What if she wants to exercise that debt?
So if you give that... I put $1 billion debt on my daughter.
Right.
But let's say over time she's not living up to my standards.
But you
I
want
to give it to someone else.
Right.
The next one would override the first one.
Right. You can cancel it.
Okay.
You can cancel it. That's why you set it up that it only takes place as of a moment before your death, then you can cancel it. But you don't want to set it up right now because she might say, okay, where's the money? You know, yeah.
So some people have citizenship in Israel as well as in the U.S.
Yeah.
Does Israel work the same? Which law?
I don't know how that works. I don't know how inheritance law and halacha work in Israel with the Beis Dins and all that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, you know? Maybe I'll find out one day.
Yeah.
So what happens to the property of an heir that passes with no people who inherit it?
So if the ger has no heirs, then the ger can write whatever type of will they want. And you know, they're not conflicting with any Torah law. So they can give it to the shul, give it to a friend, or the shelter for homeless cats, or whatever, you know, however they want it. Okay, yeah.
So what if you were the recipient of the will? Do you need to go back to your brother, the Bahor, something back?
So then you need to straighten it out. You need to straighten it out with the Bahor. In other words, if they're brothers and the Bechor had a claim, then the Bechor needs to waive. He can waive the claim or he can gift it back to you.
I mean, he never said anything to Bechor. Why go to him and say?
Well, forget about Bechor. You have to deal with all your brothers. Because as a daughter, you didn't have a right to anything. So forget
even
about
today,
the
Bechor. Even today.
Yeah, if there was an inheritance, and as a daughter, you received a share along with your brothers, then they were really supposed to get your share. And it was between them to divide it up, however they're going to divide it up, firstborn or whatever.
So I need to go back to the brothers?
And the brothers have to really forgive you or gift you the share that was coming to them.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned a certain amount in the will versus whatever is in my estate. So if you do that and then you don't have the money when you actually did die, it's not a thing where you have to go in debt.
What you do is you're supposed to create an indebtedness that exceeds the value of your entire estate. Right. And that way the heirs, the Torah heirs, have one of two choices. They'll either get something or they'll get nothing. Because, you know, let's say I have the three daughters and I give each of them $1 million. Well, there's not $3 million in the estate. So let's say there's $1 million in the estate. So the three daughters will divide up, you know, each $330,000, and the sons will get nothing. So they're much smarter to say, I'll go with the rules of the estate, with the will as stated. Okay, Shkayach, thank you all for coming, and thank you all for necessitating me to prepare this because I learned a ton.
Thank you very much.
So some of this is still today. Some of it is still...